We begin the hour, as we do each Tuesday, by saying hello to our friend, the uber-talented writer, author of the wonderful new book, Meatheads Say the Realest Things. Get it? Give it to a friend as a gift. Make a new friend by just handing them a copy that you paid for. Colin Fleming with us. Hello there, Colin.
You're back, and we are reunited.
And it feels so good, yes.
Peppermint and Patty. Yeah.
And What Did I See is on tonight for a holiday special, one of your favorites.
Yes, and I have the opportunity, allowing that I'm still awake, because I'm like a 127-year-old man, Rudolph. 1964, he does this thing, and you Rudolph connoisseurs out there, you might have it on Blu-ray, and I do too, somewhere in storage, and I won't be able to locate it until I get my house back, but I can tell you, as I feel like the foremost Rudolph connoisseur, that it's even better live.
Oh, yeah, so I agree with you on that. The only thing better would be an old battered VHS copy that you taped off the network 25 years ago.
Yes, and I like the aggressive, we'll call it aggressive, spirit of the first portion of the special. Now, some might call it abusive, but I like a brisk pace and a little bit of hard love.
Yes, I agree completely on that. But that's only a little of what we're talking about, because on tap this afternoon, we'll talk about a wonderful short story of yours called Post Fletcher. But want to begin with discussing a wonderful recent piece published at the Smart Set, smartset.com. It's called Restoration, Bob Dylan's Long Songs and the Art of the Turn-On. And let me say right away, I'm impressed with your use of the word swain.
Yeah, the piece starts with me talking about being a swain, but then I have to qualify it, a would-be swain, because I was no Lothario and or Richard Kimball when I was in high school. I wasn't exactly having dates under the apple tree with the ladies. So it was a lot of me on my own and going to hockey practice and staying after class and reading up on Shakespeare when I didn't have to and listening to a lot of music, not on VHS, but on actual cassette tapes, which I still do, actually. And I'd listen to, like, the Yardbirds or the Doors, the Animals. Those were the bands I was really into. And a lot of Dylan on tape and driving around from one place to another. This was in rural Connecticut, in Ridgefield, Connecticut. So things seemed to take a while. It wasn't like being in a city when you just sort of walked across the street or a few blocks or whatnot. And I'd listen to a lot of Bob Dylan's long songs and think a lot about Bob Dylan's long songs, because he was really, in my view, the best at making long songs. Because when other people had long songs, they tended not to, they repeated a lot. They didn't have a lot of sort of that through composed nature that you get with a Dylan long song.
And you refer to them in the piece as list songs. What do you mean by that?
I think a lot of life can be looked at as a series of lists. We can look at things a lot of different ways that we don't normally look at them. And I think doing so allows us to see them more accurately as they are. Like, for instance, you can look at a story as a piece of architecture. You can look at it as a work of sound. You can look at it as a painting brought to life in a different kind of way. And I think when we look at our own lives, they lend themselves towards a kind of compilation of lists. And people say you have like a problem. What do they say to do? Well, make a list. Make a list of all the things that you have to contend with. And what Dylan does in his long songs, typically, they have different functions, and they're certainly different from song to song, but there's some overlap. He delineates life in a sort of list form. It's almost like having paragraphs that are maybe a sentence long rather than one of those massive, like, oh, here, it's the whole half a page or whatnot. So I think it's a way of breaking down life into manageable portions, but he's also encasing that idea of compartmental life within this larger overarching framework, which is how life itself works.
And you refer to Desolation Row from Highway 61 Revisited as a chaos assimilator. Can you explain that?
Desolation Row is neat, because I've always wondered how many people get the twist at the end of Desolation Row, because you don't find out until the very end what the song is really about. But he's going through these historical figures, and it's chaotic because it's like a mixed metaphor, but it's a historical mixed metaphor. You'll see these people whose time did not overlap now living these lives, this existence, this parallel Dylan-esque plane where their lives do overlap, their histories overlap. So in that sense, he's bringing together various forms of chaos, but he's also making it work. You get to the very end of the song, and he sort of breaks that trance-like mood, because you have, think of the role that it's a guitar, but think of how much a guitar in the song sounds like a lute. It's very, like, medieval in construction. It's something you could get out of, like, the Middle Ages period of song making. And you get to the end, and you realize that the singer, who's not necessarily Dylan, has received this letter, this kind of chest-beating, harumphing letter from an egomaniacal, self-centered sort of woman. And he's, rather than read it and take it seriously, he's rewritten all of the gossip, all of the name-dropping, all of the calumny of her letter, and he's inserted this story, really, this poetical short story, and then he's just moving on with his life.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. One of my favorite Dylan songs, period, but certainly among the long songs, is Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands.
I think it is, I don't know if it's my very favorite Dylan song, but it might be. It's certainly up there. It's when they were recording Blonde on Blonde and the sessions weren't quite coming together in New York. And Dylan goes down to Nashville to record. And this is one take. I always like one take kind of songs, like The Animals, for instance, House of the Rising Sun. Next time you hear that, listeners, when you're out somewhere, realize that The Animals recorded that in one take, grumpy, early for them at 10 in the morning. And Dylan, of course, was influenced by The Animals in House of the Rising Sun. That's really the only reason that he gets to bringing it all back home when he does. He goes so-called electric. And this song, it takes a lot of confidence and awareness of your gift to allow your gift to come to you. And what I mean by that is in Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands, Dylan is a lot like Wayne Gretzky. He's letting this game come to him. He's letting this song unfurl, trusting himself throughout the unfurling process that he's going to be able to put notes where he needs to put notes, have those kind of beats of connectiveness that only someone like Dylan can really deliver. And he's able to take that leitmotif of the warehouse eyes and Arabian drums, and you think, okay, that's on the page. What does that mean? It doesn't necessarily mean anything. But when you hear it in the song, it has definite meaning. And not only definite meaning, but depending upon the verse it's in, it has different meaning.
Yeah, and I love the line that with your sheet metal memory of Cannery Row and your magazine husband who one day just had to go.
Sheet metal memory of Cannery Row. What he's doing there with the internal vowels is so Dylan-esque. And another, an earlier song, he has the line, perhaps it's the color of the sun cut flat. He's transitioning through those vowels in the same way that F. Scott Fitzgerald is at the end of The Great Gatsby. And as I sat there brooding on the old unknown world, think of the very beginning of what I just said there. And as I sat there brooding, A-E-I-O-U. He's taking it right back, Fitzgerald is. And Dylan is too, in a way, to the very origins of language, the first sort of guttural sounds that we were able to produce that meant something, although they weren't codified in language as we think of language. It was the language of primitive man, and he's bringing that kind of life circle full circle, and through that internal vowelization that he does, it becomes very sing-song. So you're not really noticing the passage of time, like, oh, we're going on here for like 15 minutes. It becomes a very downhill type of song. Like, you want as a writer to write downhill so people aren't conscious of like having to push the sled up like the mountain.
Another long song, and this is a later one from, I think, one of his best albums. I want to say recent albums. I mean, I guess it is, though it's 20-some years old now, but from Time Out of Mind, Highlands.
I do that, too. I look at, like, Radiohead, and it's like, well, I saw them in 2001. It was the first time I saw them. It's like, oh, it's pretty recent. And maybe that speaks to, I don't think it necessarily speaks to me being, like, some, like, old guy, some fuddy-duddy on a lawn that I don't have so much as, you don't get work like this very much anymore, and that was his comeback album of sorts. And when you have a career that long and you risk as much as Dylan does, and I think sometimes he's maybe not as committed as he is at other times, and this time he was pretty dialed in. And in the song, you have a series of vignettes that in and of themselves should just be rendered as vignettes, like when he goes to the singer goes and he's trying to order breakfast or whatever it is. And it shouldn't be like this scene, but it's these details. Again, we've spoken about this before, that they accrue, they stack into a narrative. And Chekhov would have understood that. What you really want to have, again, as a writer, and here you have a pronounced musical component, you want people to experience the world in a way that they think, huh, I never noticed that before. But now, and they cast their memory back, maybe they cast their memory back to lunch, then they see the world that way retroactively, and then they see the world differently going forward. So it's a song like that, and it ambulates. It's a walking song. That's the format of the song itself, Hearts in the Highlands. Like, you go to the Highlands in Scotland. You don't go there to do anything really but ramble.
And finally, from his newest album, and look, the Grammy Awards are stupid. We know that. But the fact that Rough and Rowdy Ways didn't get a nomination is beyond me. A great album. And as a history guy and somebody who loves Dylan as well, for me, those long songs don't get much better than his latest, Murder Most Foul.
You don't want to get a Grammy. Chances are, if you have gotten a Grammy, you have not made good music. Because it's very safe music. Just you go back through the years. It's like Neil Diamond beating out Sgt. Pepper. I mean, come on. Like, it's just this safe sort of like pablum. The same goes with Oscars, too. And the vanguard artist. And you can be a vanguard popular artist. You can sell millions of records. But chances are, if you're making innovative work, you're not going to be, as it's currently constituted, rewarded by body politics like that. So this song is tied into that idea of the turn-on, that we have this, and it has a sexual connotation. But back in the day, it has a drug connotation. It was sort of what I'd say to you, like if I had you over my house and I had some bootleg of Dylan, like, let me turn you on to this. And you might not have heard that before. That's how that works. And we have a society now where people don't know anything. At most, they tend to know of something. Like, everyone out there, they know of Thoreau, and they could maybe answer a Jeopardy question about Walt, but they don't know anything actually about him. And Dylan is someone who knows a lot about a lot of different things. And when you know a lot about a lot of different things, and you're already smarter than everyone else, now you're pulling on all of these different forms of art, all of this insight from all of these other people, you become a powerhouse that other people just aren't. And so it's really a song about that accumulation of knowledge on top of the knowledge that Dylan, or the singer of the song, was already developing. And of course, he references like 103 people or whatever it is.
And you mentioned too, the instrumental backing is so unique on Murder Most Foul and adds, well, it adds a different color, not just to the sound of the song, but to Dylan's voice.
Yes, he has to plan, and he always has. And this would, of course, change because Dylan's voice has changed so much. And people hearing me say that might think like, okay, he sounds like some sort of dry-throated toad and has for a while at this point, but that's not really accurate. His voice changed a lot from 1963 to 1965, and from 65 to 66. It's like this honeyed glaze at times on Blonde on Blonde, and then it changes a lot on John Wesley Harding. It changes a lot, certainly, on Nashville Skyline, so forth. So I think he now, like the way Mozart would write, he'd be like, oh, I really like how you sing. Soprano, I'm going to write this particular part of this opera. I'm going to tailor this for you. And I think Dylan now writes the instrumental backing, and it's just a head chart. It's not actually written out. But I think he writes that and instructs with in mind for how that's going to pair with his voice. You cannot have the sort of soundscape of Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands anymore. Dylan's voice would get lost in a mix like that. So this is patented to bring out his vocal strengths at this point.
You can read Colin's entire piece. It is terrific at thesmartset.com. From there, let's talk about a recent short story of yours that I love. It's called Post Fletcher. Man, I don't even know how to begin other than to say, well, essentially, it's the story of a man who is still alive, who has a spirit of himself haunting his old house.
Yeah, it's in a magazine called restriction. And this guy, Fletcher, he's out at like the annual cook-off or whatever, right, at the beach. It's this local seaside type of town. And the officious sort of like head of the body, the government, whatever you want to call it there, you know how those like small town things can be. He's like, well, we've been meaning to talk to you. We have a problem. And you know that this guy Fletcher has not really been doing too well. That you don't know exactly what has happened at first, but he is not all together. He's mentally all together, but he's kind of a broken guy who just would, it makes me think of like a line of Sam Malone on Cheers when Woody is asking Sam Malone how to deal with the problem. And Sam says, ignore the problem. It'll go away. And that's sort of how this guy's living his life at this point. And the head of the selectmen says, we have a problem, dude. We didn't know how to bring this up with you, but your ghost is really causing some problems around here. And Fletcher's like, well, I'm not dead. And the selectman's like, nonetheless. So he sort of becomes this chaperone for his own ghost. And the ghost lives, I thought this was funny in the story that's really not very funny in many ways. The ghost lives quite an active life. Like he goes clamming and everything. And the ghost turns up at certain points. And sometimes only Fletcher can see him. And the ghost does some things that maybe the ghost shouldn't be doing as a proper temporary citizen of the town. And we learn that Fletcher is divorced. He is living with a friend and his friend's wife down the road from his old house, which he can't face anymore. He's had a hard time even putting it up on the market. And his ex-wife is settled and she's on the opposite coast. And they still have something of a relationship. And they have a more fruitful relationship than they used to have. And we find out ultimately, I think it's pretty searing, it's pretty gutting, right? Why the ghost, why Fletcher has this ghost named Post Fletcher during the story.
And I love the fact that it becomes especially problematic because, well, Post Fletcher is just, he's a downer. He's bringing people down around the community.
Yes, he gets into the mood. There's like a negative vibe coming off of Post Fletcher. And he has like a pet turtle and it's like in a little leash and it's just like kind of dead and everything. And there's this woman out clamming and he sort of like frightens her when he's doing that. And he just is bringing everyone down and people don't really want this. And they're not especially empathetic to either Fletcher or Post Fletcher. And I think that calls into question the very nature of empathy, because empathy is something that I think is pretty rare in this world. And empathy isn't the same as wishing something to go differently for somebody who's in your life. That's completely different than empathy. Empathy takes a great deal of energy and it takes a lot of imagination, because you have to be able to put yourself into someone else's situation. And it's so different from just saying, I hope this works out for you. I hope it goes the way you want it to, this divorce, or whatever it might be. And so Post Fletcher's bringing people down, but they have an affinity for each other, Fletcher and Post Fletcher. And Fletcher doesn't know really why he's there. It's one of those stories that you want to find out why this dynamic exists, which is just one of the crucial tenets, I think, of artful fiction making. Make people need to know why and what comes next. That's how you pull people in. And then you add filigree, you do all these other different things. But that's such a basic thing to make people have a compulsion, to impel them to turn the page as if like a portion of themselves depends on knowing what happens. And Fletcher's at this diner and he's having breakfast with these people and the selectmen and everything. And he sees Post Fletcher outside kind of in the rain and he's fading, like he's not going to be around much longer. And we find ultimately what has happened with this guy's wife. And really, I'd say ultimately, it becomes, although you don't expect it at first, it becomes a story about the nature of how we say goodbye.
Absolutely. And it's very powerful. It's, well, you know, like meatheads say the realest things. It's laugh out loud funny, and then it gets you with that gut punch at the end and makes you want to go back, as I did, and read it again and say, oh, I still don't see it coming, but wow. It's powerful stuff, as always. It's called Post Fletcher. Check it out, from Colin Fleming. Visit Colin's website at colinflemminglit.com. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog. And, as I said, for yourself, for a friend, for someone you'd like to be your friend, buy a copy of Meatheads Say the Realest Things, and you'll be glad you did. Colin, we thank you, as always. Have a good week, and we'll check in next Tuesday.
Okay, sounds good. Bye.
Colin Fleming. every week on Downtown.